This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. When healthcare policy is debated, some warn that a greater role for government means bureaucrats will be rationing care. Others counter that insurance companies are already doing that. Our guest, Greg Block, is a health policy analyst who says doctors themselves increasingly have to decide which patients will get expensive tests and treatments and which ones won't. In his new book, Block argues that modern medicine forces doctors to disregard the Hippocratic Oath, which obliges them to put their patients' interests above all else. He says society needs to rethink the relationship between physician and patient and be more honest about the choices that are made in providing health care. Greg Block is a graduate of both Yale Law School and the Yale Medical School, and he completed a residency in psychiatry at the Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center. He was a health policy advisor to Barack Obama's presidential campaign, and he's now a professor of law at Georgetown University. His new book is The Hippocratic Myth: Why Doctors Are Under Pressure to Ration Care, Practice Politics, and Compromise Their Promise to Heal. Well, Greg Block, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, you write in the book that under the healthcare system we have now, doctors are often put in the position of rationing care, withholding or denying some treatments or tests, sometimes without even really being aware of it. Give us an example of how this works.
Yeah, let me tell you about Sarah. Sarah was an 82-year-old grandma who was visiting her daughter, and she suffers a massive heart attack. Paramedics rush her to the hospital. She's quickly taken to the intensive care unit and put on all manner of monitors with fancy chemicals dripping into her body through all sorts of tubes. And this is costing tens of thousands of dollars just to keep her alive for a few days. The doctors come to a conclusion that her prognosis is dismal. They think she almost certainly is not going to make it. And in their minds, understandably, almost certainly becomes certainly. And they tell Sarah and her daughter that things look really dismal and that they'd better start making plans, end-of-life plans, and that it didn't make sense to continue aggressive treatment. And only later does a doctor come in, say something really tactless about how much it costs to provide all this treatment. The reference to cost causes the daughter to flip out, become enraged, and to demand all aggressive treatment. And the doctors, afraid of the daughter, go ahead and treat Sarah really aggressively. And within a couple of weeks, Sarah walks out of the hospital on her own power, and she lives for another year or so. And for the doctors, this was a shock, because the tiny, tiny chance that Sarah could make it became, in their minds, a zero chance. The fact that she made it shows that there was a chance. But the reality was that these doctors were under tremendous pressure to set limits on behalf of their health plan. Tremendous pressure not to spend tens of thousands of dollars on Sarah when they were pretty sure that she wasn't going to make it. And I talked to one of the doctors later on, one of the doctors involved in these decisions. And you know what he told me? He told me, yeah, we ration care. We ration care every day. And so sometimes doctors are aware of it, and sometimes they're not, because it's so at odds with the Hippocratic ideal that they kind of push it to the back of their mind and then out of their mind.
And what was that tactless thing that the doctor said to Sarah's daughter?
Well, one of the doctors comes into the intensive care unit while Sarah's daughter is sitting by the bedside and says, well, have you ever stayed in a really expensive hotel? And Sarah says, yeah, I guess so. And the doctor says, well, you know, how much do you think an expensive hotel costs? Sarah says, maybe $600, $800. And the doctor says, well, this room costs $10,000. And, of course, the message there is you are wasting the public's money by being here. You're wasting the public's money by continuing to breathe. And it was that moment that led Sarah's daughter to flip out, to become furious. That moment of loss of trust. And what are the lessons that the doctors, the other doctors, took from that? Well, not that covert rationing is a bad thing, but rather we've got to do better at keeping the relationship intact, because we can't afford to provide Sarah that room in that really expensive hotel.
Now, help us understand what it is doctors are thinking about when they, you know, deny a treatment that might be beneficial but is expensive. Is it because they have rules from a medical director above them? Do they get a cash incentive for saving money? How does it actually work?
Increasingly, we're seeing financial incentives to be frugal. In fact, actually, in the health reform bill, one provision that's troubling in a law that, for the most part, I think is a wonderful moral advance for our country, one provision that's troubling is the creation of so-called accountable care organizations that might well have Medicare in the business of giving doctors incentives covertly to skimp on care. I think we'll be seeing more of this. We also certainly have rules being set by medical directors in large medical group practices, rules that lay out policies for limit setting. What we don't have, Dave, what we don't have, and this is really a troubling thing, what we don't have is candor in health insurance contracts and in the laws and regulations that govern Medicare and other public programs. Candor about the balances to be struck between costs and benefits.
Now, you're right that insurers typically promise to pay for any treatment that is, quote, medically necessary, unquote, right?
Now, exactly.
That sounds pretty clear. You got to do what you need to do. Why does it leave wiggle room?
Well, the average person thinks that medically necessary care means all care that might potentially be beneficial. But the reality is it's a wide-open term. It typically gets construed by courts and administrative agencies to mean the care that most doctors provide. And so doctors get to set the standards. But patients and the public expect that it means all necessary care. And so when we find examples of covert rationing, when we find examples of potentially beneficial care being denied, we tend to get really angry.
And I'm sure a number of cases have gone to court on this. What do the courts say about the legality of rationing care based on cost, on saving money?
Well, the courts have been all over the map on this issue. The U.S. Supreme Court, 11 years ago, in a unanimous decision in a case known as Pegram versus Herdrick, said explicitly that HMOs ration care, they offer doctors incentives to ration care, that that is legal, that the Congress of the United States approved of this when it enacted the HMO Act back in the early 1970s, and that there ought be no liability for it, at least under federal law. But other courts, state courts, in hearing cases when insurance companies have refused to cover care, have oftentimes insisted on the provision of all potentially beneficial care. And to a large extent, the courts defer to doctors to set standards of care.
Well, you've told us how doctors are often withholding care in some cases, rationing it, sometimes consciously, sometimes unconsciously. But you also believe that, in a way, this is inevitable, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Why?
Well, first of all, we're going to have to find some way to set limits. We cannot afford anything like what we're spending on healthcare today, and we're certainly not going to be able to afford what we're projected to spend in the future. We spend almost a fifth of our national income today on medical care, and within 25 years, unless we change dramatically, we're going to be spending about a third of our national income on medical care. And we're doing that by borrowing from our kids. This is a huge part of why we're running a $1.5 trillion federal budget deficit and why those deficits are projected to continue at nightmarish levels. The debates in Congress today over discretionary spending, chump change compared to what we're spending on the Medicare program and the Medicaid program. So we have to find some ways to set limits.
Now, you've written that a lot of people say that 30% of health spending is wasted on care that is not effective. If we know that a lot of the tests and treatments that we're providing don't really help, how do we get a handle on that? I mean, can you wean out those which aren't effective and thereby reduce costs?
To some extent, yes, but that's not going to be the whole of the solution to our problem of healthcare costs. There's two things going on here. Number one, we're just not putting the resources into doing research on which treatments do and don't work that we ought to be putting in. Now, the health reform law takes a big step forward with an unprecedented commitment to what's called, what we health policy wonks call comparative effect in this research. That's just a fancy way of referring to research that tries to figure out which of the treatments we use now actually work. What's amazing is that probably only about 10 to 20% of the treatments that doctors use today have been tested based on the so-called gold standard of clinical science, the randomized clinical trial. And then even when a treatment is shown to work really well for the sample that's studied in the clinical trial, in the real world, patients are all different. And so we're never going to be able to have solid science to tell us in advance for sure whether a treatment is going to work or not. So let's do the research, but let's be realistic. Let's be pragmatic about the limits of that research.
Now, one of the things you write in the book is that when high-tech, very expensive treatments and tests are developed, they tend to get employed and patients build for them, whether we really know whether they work or not. Can you give us an example of that?
Exactly. Well, one recent example, a really nice piece by the health journalist Julie Appleby, sets this example out. Back in 2007, a so-called 64-slice CT scanner came into use, really high resolution. Cardiologists loved it. They started buying it for their offices.
What does that mean, 64-slice?
It means 64 different levels of images very close together. A CT scanner works by taking a cross-section of the part of the body that it's scanning.
So you get a three-dimensional picture, in other words, right?
Exactly. It's a three-dimensional picture that's made up from a whole bunch of slices. Imagine looking at cross-sections at multiple levels of something. You can do a cross-section of the brain at multiple levels. And the closer the cross-sections are to each other, the finer the resolution on the CT scan. So 64-slice is just a fancy way of saying a really high-resolution CT scanner. So high in its resolution that you could put people in it and look at their hearts and figure out how much coronary artery blockage they had without putting a catheter inside their arteries to pump dye into their arteries, which was a rather scary way of assessing levels of coronary artery blockage. So the cardiologists loved this. They could buy this machine and charge a huge amount for it and show beautiful pictures, stunning pictures, colorful pictures of people's coronary arteries and the degree of blockage. Only thing is that this test turned out only proved useful for a very small number of patients who had serious coronary vascular disease. Medicare agreed to pay for it only for this small number of patients, but the cardiologists exercised their right to petition their government. They lobbied Congress. 79 congressmen from both parties wrote a letter to the agency that runs Medicare saying, cover this thing. Medicare soon rescinded its limiting rule and agreed to cover the test much more broadly. So politics plays a big role in the movement of expensive technologies that yield only tiny benefits right into the marketplace. And then the developers of these technologies know that, and so they keep spending. The investment bankers know it. The venture capitalists know it. And so the money train of investment keeps pouring resources into the development of technologies that are at once astonishingly, dazzlingly impressive in engineering terms and in computer software terms, and really crude in terms of the human biology that they rely upon.
So it seems we have two things working at cross purposes here. We have this expensive stuff being developed that may be marginally effective, but which then gets used a lot because powerful interests promote them. But then you have health plans saying, not so fast. We think we can give you Tylenol and send you home.
Exactly. And the two sides represent the two sides of us. The special interests who are able to get their technologies onto the market despite lack of proof that they work rely upon us loving the technologies, having hope in the technologies, and believing that those technologies will save grandma. That's why they were able to get 79 congressmen, in the case of the 64-slice CT scanner, to write in, because those congressmen know that it's really easy to portray government as stinting on grandma's care.
And doctors, I mean, one of the examples that you point to is doctors, how often should they order MRIs for women looking for breast cancer, right?
Right.
And there's a truly legitimate question there about how often those should be ordered. And they're expensive, right?
That's right.
Is that one of those cases where you think in the real world, in a rational world, doctors are going to have to make some tough decisions and use that less frequently than you would if you wanted to be completely thorough and catch every single case. How do we make that calculation?
Yeah, there's a tiny, tiny advantage that you can gain in lots of cases by doing an MRI to assess the risk of breast cancer compared to doing a mammogram. And yet doing an MRI can cost upwards of $1,000. A mammogram is, of course, much cheaper. And so there's a balance to be struck there. We need to talk openly about that balance. Right now, the practice rules that tell doctors when they should and shouldn't order MRIs to screen for breast cancer say nothing explicitly about the role of costs. We need to have an open conversation about how to count costs, about how to count costs not just when we're talking about MRIs to rule out breast cancer, but in a bunch of other situations involving both diagnostic screening tests and actual treatment. If we have an open discussion of costs, if we have rules about how much costs will count in health plan contracts so that people can make choices in advance, then, you know what? We will have a sense of tragedy. We will have a sense of possibilities foreclosed by the realities of our budgets. But we will not have the kind of outrage that emerges when we think our doctors are doing all, and in fact, they've covertly counted costs.
You say in discussing what we need to do that we need to empower doctors to say no to care that's technologically possible and may prolong life, that you have to empower doctors to do so even when the consequences seem tragic, and develop rules that will at times result in heart-rending outcomes. And it strikes me that this involves really hundreds of decisions about different kinds of tests and treatments. You decide what's a reasonable, rational set of recommendations, and then you expect doctors to tell their patients, we as a society have decided we can't afford to give you this test for this condition.
What the doctor can then do is to say to her or his patient, that's not something that I'm allowed to do. That's not something that the rules permit me to do. Just like a lawyer is not allowed to present false information to a tribunal, even though it's a lawyer's obligation to stand by his or her client. The key here is that society ought to be making these rules. We make these rules in other parts of our public and private lives. The federal government values life for the purpose of making decisions about airline safety, making decisions about occupational safety. The Environmental Protection Agency acts based on values of life. And the Office of Management and Budget within the White House tries to make sure that regulations are consistent in different agencies in how they value life. In fact, there's people who research this, and the general consensus is that we value life for purposes of public policy roughly between $5 and $10 million per life saved. Now, this all sounds pretty brutal. It certainly is a way in which economics earns its moniker, the dismal science. But the reality is, if we go above that, if we say spend $50 million to save a life in healthcare as opposed to $5 to $10 million, then that's $50 million we don't have to save a bunch of other lives. And that's $50 million that leads to the sacrifice of other people's lives. And so those decisions need to be made as visibly, as publicly in healthcare as they are in other areas of our public affairs.
Well, Greg Block, it's been interesting. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Dave, for having me.
Greg Block is a health policy analyst and law professor at Georgetown University. His new book is called The Hippocratic Myth. Owsley Stanley, a sound engineer who's better known for mixing high-quality LSD for the Grateful Dead, the Beatles, Jimi Hendrix, Ken Kesey, and others, died Sunday in Australia in an auto accident. He was 76. The Oxford English Dictionary includes the noun Owsley to mean a potent form of LSD. Owsley also designed the Dead's Skull and Lightning Bolt logo and the Wall of Sound sound system, which the Grateful Dead used in their live performances. This one was recorded in 1971. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Among the ritual sounds of spring in America are the crack of bats and the snap of leather as baseball revives for another season. But just how old is the national pastime? The guy to ask is our guest, John Thorne, who was recently named the official historian of Major League Baseball. He spent a lifetime studying and writing about baseball, and in his new book, he researches what he calls the Paleolithic era of the game. He believes some form of baseball may date back to the American Revolution. For much of the 20th century, Americans believed the story that baseball was invented by Abner Doubleday in Cooperstown, New York, around 1840. That tale has been discredited for years, and Thorne says it's clear baseball has no single inventor, that it evolved over time. Thorne's book is called Baseball in the Garden of Eden, The Secret History of the Early Game. He notes on the first page that you can find a reference to baseball in a 1798 Jane Austen novel. I asked him to begin with a reading from the introduction.
Reflecting on the appeal of history in Jane Austen's Northanger Abbey, heroine Catherine Morland comments, "I often think it odd that it should be so dull, for a great deal of it must be invention." Indeed, and in no field of American endeavor is invention more rampant than in baseball, whose whole history is alive from beginning to end, from its creation myth to its rosy models of commerce, community, and fair play. The game's epic feats and revered figures, its pieties about racial harmony and bleacher democracy, its artful blurring of sport and business, all of it is bunk, tossed up with a wink and a nudge. Yet we love both the game and the flim-flam because they are both so American. Baseball has been blessed in equal measure by Lincoln and by Barnum.
Well, John Thorne, it's great to have you here. You do spend a lot of time documenting the game in the early 19th century. You said there were different versions of the game in Massachusetts and New York. How did they differ?
The Massachusetts game is far older and involved overhand throwing by what we call today the pitcher. It had anywhere from 9 to 14 in the field and sometimes more. You would be thrown out. A ball would plunk you in the ribs between the bases, and this is part of the delight, the sadistic delight of this game, that you could create an injury to an opponent's pride, if not to his body, because the ball was actually rather soft. The New York game, which is in its essence the same game, they're both baseball games. The New York game's distinctions involve the creation of foul territory, the inability of putting a batter out between the bases in this undignified way. You have to tag him out or force him out at a base.
So you couldn't plunk him, in other words.
You couldn't plunk him. But the New York game had the underhand pitching style, which made batting very much easier.
And something more like the New York game eventually won out, right? Do we know why?
I believe the New York game won out through superior PR, because I have played recreation games. I have umpired recreation games of the Massachusetts game, and it is a fantastically fun game both to play and to watch. And how it became the game that got away is beyond me, because the New York game, I think, in many measures, is inferior. It claimed for itself manliness and gentlemanly conduct, but manliness was really a characteristic of the Massachusetts game. That's where bravery was on display.
Because you could get hit by the baseball?
Also because you did not have to stay between the base paths while you were running, so you could lead your opponents on a merry chase into the outfield and beyond.
And there was no foul territory in the Massachusetts game?
No foul territory. So one of the particular skills of the Massachusetts game was what they called slide hitting. So you would position your hands on the bat and raise the upper hand so that the ball would be ticked behind you between the additional catchers or scouts that were behind the primary catcher, and you would just run for days.
And there were four bases?
There were four bases plus home plate.
Right. So you were to touch each base in succession once the ball went in some direction, but you might run all over the place avoiding hurled balls in between.
In fact, the distance between the home plate or striker's point and first base was very small, so almost everybody was able to get to first. But then getting around the bases, that was the tough part.
You know, I have to say that people who are used to the modern game might listen to that description of the Massachusetts game and say, it's not baseball, it's chaos. But you've umpired it, you like it.
I like it, and it is structured chaos. It is not mere tag, a game that we know from Spencer's Fairy Queen as base or prisoner's base. It has rules, it has regulations, and it rewards skill.
Was the game back then an urban game or a rural game or both?
Both. It is, I believe, the game predates cities as we know them. The game did not arise in an urban slum. This is a farm game brought to the cities and then exported back to the farms. And one of the charms of this Edenic pastime, particularly for bachelors in the city, is it reminded them of the farms they had just left behind.
Huh. And how did you determine that it migrated from farm to city?
The earliest mentions that we can find of baseball by old-timers take you back to West Central Massachusetts in the 1750s, 40s, and in one citation, 1735. The game has no record in the cities until at the very earliest, 1805, and more likely the famous find by George Thompson of two ball clubs scheduled to play in order to promote drinks and revelry at Jones's Cottage in New York in 1823 at the corner of what is now 8th Street and Broadway.
And when the game was played in the early 19th century, were there uniforms? I take it they did not have fielding gloves, right?
No, fielding gloves are a much later innovation, the 1870s. And there's no indication that the early clubs had uniforms, but they may have worn ribbons on the fronts of their shirts. They may have worn ribbons on their jerseys, because the exchange of ribbons, which is a very medieval custom, was a part of the organized game from its earliest days, that the winning team would entertain the losing team at a post-game banquet and they would exchange prizes.
And how did the ribbon figure in?
The ribbon was something that was worn on the jersey during the game of each club, and the losing club would forfeit its ribbons to the winning club.
So you tell us that, you know, baseball got going probably in the 18th century and was actively played in the early 19th century, and then really kind of came into its own after the Civil War. How much was gambling a part of the whole thing?
I don't think you could have had the rise of baseball without gambling. Baseball was a boys' game and not worthy of the attention of adults, not worthy of press coverage. What made baseball seem important was when gamblers figured out a way to spur interest in it, so that gambling, which has become, of course, the original sin for current baseball, courtesy of the 1877 Louisville fix, the Black Sox scandal, Pete Rose, you name it. In the beginning, there were people who turned their noses up at gambling, but they recognized the necessity of it. It was, you would not have had a box score. You would not have had an assessment of individual skills. You would not have had one player of skill moving to another club if there were not gambling in it.
So you had organized baseball clubs. Now, did the gambling sort of begin external to that? That is to say, people who ran gambling games on the street discovered that it was fun, that people would be interested in watching a game if they would take and pay bets on it?
Yes, absolutely. There were touts at the ball games with pasteboards in hand, and they would be taking their bets between innings. They would bet on the outcome of an individual at bat. It was absolutely rampant. When gamblers were banned from the sidelines, and they formerly had a section of the bleachers devoted to them, it was the pool box. The pool box was banned. So pool rooms grew up right around the ballpark, and people who were not playing billiards, the name which subsequently became known as pool, was not originally pool, bet these tandems much the way the country is seized with betting on the NCAA Final Four.
Well, money always helps to fertilize the growth of any new enterprise. So how did the gambling money then get into the game itself? I mean, did they pay players?
inevitably, when players were a combination, when ball-playing teams were a combination of amateurs and pros, or whether they were going for a percentage of the gate and some star was salaried and everybody else was on the hook, it was easy to approach a ball player and say, look, I'll give you as much for this game as you would make the entire year if you'll help to throw the game. So game fixing, which we think of as the Black Sox scandal in 1919, dates as early as 1865. That is when we had our first scandal and three players were banned.
And in this post-Civil War period, were the teams professional? Were they paid to play the game?
We think of the 1869 Cincinnati Red Stockings, the unbeaten squad that toured from one coast to another and was undefeated in 57 first-rate games and a handful of others against scrub teams. We think of them as the first professionals, but professionalism had entered the game, certainly by the mid-1860s, and ballplayers we know were being paid by the beginning of the 1860s. The first all-professional team probably dates to about 1866.
You know, we said we like to think of baseball as sort of fixed and unchanging, but it has changed. What are some of the major changes that we saw, you know, from the game of the 1880s to the modern game?
I think enclosed ballparks is of enormous importance because now you had a fence, no matter how distant, that you could hit the ball over. And little by little, slugging came into the game. Now, Ty Cobb, Sam Crawford, Frank Chance, you name the hitting heroes of the first decade of the century. There was no point in them hitting the ball, swinging at a pitch the way Babe Ruth did, because they weren't going to drive an old mushy ball in the seventh inning over a fence 500 feet away anyway. The innovation of enclosed fields and ever-diminishing distances to the wall, so the ball players get larger, the fields get smaller, power becomes more easy to accomplish. The game changes. Pitching becomes a game of throwing breaking balls. You can't throw a ball down the middle. You cannot take it easy with batters 7, 8, and 9 because anybody can hurt you in today's lineup.
So the fact that they enclosed the fields and made them close enough for hitters to hit a ball out of the ballpark required pitchers to pitch more aggressively and not give hitters that chance.
Actually, Dave, I would say they began to pitch more defensively. Mm-hmm. Today's pitcher nibbles at the corners, throws more breaking pitches than fastballs with a handful of exceptions, and those exceptions tend to be relief pitchers. So good old country hardball, the kind of ball that Cy Young might throw or Walter Johnson might throw, that's pretty much a thing of the past for a starting pitcher.
And the ball itself, how much has it changed since, say, the Civil War?
The ball between the Civil War and, say, 1900, there's a lot of variation. The home clubs supplied the ball, and those home clubs that had good hitting clubs might supply a livelier ball. The league made specifications as to how the ball should be made beginning in the 1870s, but these were sometimes ignored. Taking a ball that had been bashed around for four or five innings and replacing it with a clean ball, this didn't start until the 1920s. It was after a Cleveland shortstop named Ray Chapman was hit in the head on a cloudy day by an underarm submarine delivery pitch by Carl Mays, and he died a day later, that the white baseball became paramount. Formerly, it was mushy, it was dirty, and the pitchers had an edge.
And when did the rule that allowed you to get someone out in the field by throwing the ball at him and plunking him, when did that disappear?
This is this idea that archaic versions of baseball disappear is mistaken. They survive. When I was a boy, I played ball games in which you could be struck by the ball between the bases and retired. So the archaic versions go back to the farm or go back to the playground. But in the Knickerbocker Baseball Club rules of 1845 and the rules as formalized at the convention in 1857 and then expanded upon by the major leagues in the years in the 1870s and beyond, Soaking was never on the highest level of play, but it continued to lurk at the town level or county level.
Soaking, that's whacking somebody?
Soaking, plugging, yep.
Okay. Did you play baseball as a youngster?
I played baseball poorly. I had a pretty good glove. I could run. But I never mastered hitting. You know, I was always behind the decent fastball. I couldn't pull.
And have you always been passionate about the game?
Baseball was more than a passion for me. It was my ticket to becoming an American. I was born in a displaced persons camp to Holocaust survivors. And when I came over at 2 and a half, I had already begun to speak German, but I was stateless. I learned English by being thrust into a nursery school environment and learning to read off the backs of cereal boxes and baseball cards. So I fell in love with the cards before I'd ever seen a game.
You're now Major League Baseball's official historian. What does that mean? What do you do?
I serve. That is my mission. My mission is, I take it philosophically to mean that baseball has looked at what I've done over the years and thought that I might be helpful in attaching younger fans to the joys of the history of the game. That baseball is a tremendously exciting game. There's no question that the game as played on the field today is far better than it was 20 years ago, 40 years ago, 60 years ago, and so on. However, some things have been lost in terms of our attachment to story, and I'm hoping that I can make the game's history come to life.
Do you have a favorite place to watch a game?
At my age, which is 63, I will say that the trip to the ballpark, which involves a 2.5 hour trip, a 2.5 hour auto trip each way, becomes a little rigorous. So the shorter distance to the refrigerator from my couch is very appealing.
What about minor league ballparks? They're everywhere. Great fun, aren't they?
Minor league ball is great. If any of our listeners are major league fans who have not seen minor league ball, I cannot urge them strongly enough to try it. If you want to see where the old ball game lives, this is where it lives.
Well, John Thorne, it's been fun. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Dave.
John Thorne is the official historian of Major League Baseball. His new book is Baseball in the Garden of Eden, The Secret History of the Early Game. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Ed Ward on country soul singer Percy Sledge. This is Fresh Air. The great singers from the golden era of soul tend to fall into one of two categories. There's gospel soul, whose vocal technique comes from the church, with singers like Aretha Franklin or Wilson Pickett, who actually started singing in church. And then there's country soul, which tends to be quieter and sung by people with rural backgrounds, like Arthur Alexander, Swamp Dog, and the master of country soul, Percy Sledge. Rhino Records has recently released Sledge's complete Atlantic recordings. Here's rock historian Ed Ward.
Percy Sledge was unhappy. His high school sweetheart had dumped him and gone to L.A. to be a model, taking one of his best friends with her. It was Christmas Eve, 1965, and he was performing with the Esquire's Combo at a health club in Sheffield, Alabama. In the middle of the set, he just lost it. "Just hit me a chord on the keyboard," he told the organist Pop Wright, and he began improvising a song, "Why Did You Leave Me, Baby?" Quinn Ivey, who'd been producing some records locally, was there and invited him to record it. It was the moment Percy'd been waiting for, ever since he'd left Layton, Alabama from Russell Shoals, a larger town where Arthur Alexander and Percy's cousin, Jimmy Hughes, had already recorded hits. He'd been bugging Jimmy to tell Rick Hall, the owner of Fame Studios, where Jimmy'd recorded, about him. There were a bunch of young white guys hanging around the studio, writing songs and playing in the house band, including Dan Penn, Spooner Oldham, and Jimmy Johnson, and when Percy approached them with "Why Did You Leave Me, Baby?", they thought the melody was great, but the lyrics needed work. Percy went to his mother's house and worked steadily for 3 weeks and finally came back to Quinn Ivy with the new version. Explaining his absence, he told Ivy, "When a man loves a woman, he can't keep his mind on nothing else." Ivy's ears perked up, and he and Percy and a few of the other guys got to work, and before long, they set Percy up in the vocal booth and started recording. Meanwhile, in New York, Jerry Wexler of Atlantic Records was in search of a new studio in the South to record soul artists in, and when he got a call from Rick Hall about When a Man Loves a Woman, he asked to hear it. He signed Percy Sledge right away and took the record and added some extra horn parts in a Memphis studio, then Rush released it. "Doesn't it sound better now?" he asked Hall during a phone call. Hall had to tell him that, in the rush, Wexler had released the original version. It sold like crazy, hitting the top of the soul and pop charts in early 1966. 3 months later, Percy had another hit, Warm and Tender Love, but it was with Dan Penn and Spooner Oldham that he was to do his most spectacular work. They seemed to be able to write songs that fit his sense of drama perfectly. I see you walk with me. I see you talk. Both Warm and Tender Love and It Tears Me Up were hits in 1966. Top 10 soul, top 20 pop, against heavy competition. But the greatest Penn Oldham masterpiece in his career didn't do very well at all. Maybe there was just too much else happening in 1967, or maybe the song was too subtle for the radio. When least expected, fate stumbles in. Bring light to the darkness. Oh, what a friend. I needed someone to call my home. Suddenly, remarkably eclectic range of material. Country songs, Ray Charles songs, Bee Gees songs, and made them all his own. There's probably no two soul singers as dissimilar as Percy Sledge and Wilson Pickett, but listen to what he does with Pickett's first hit. Yeah. Found a Love, though, was only released in Germany, which was symptomatic of where soul music was in 1974, in decline in the United States. Percy was still big in Europe, and he was huge in South Africa, where his 1970 tour, in the middle of a cultural boycott, didn't help his image back home. But as times changed, Percy Sledge didn't. He was nominated for a Grammy in 1995, and in 2005, he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's still at it, not touring as much as he once did, but still playing, mostly in the South. Go see him if you get a chance.
Ed Ward lives in the south of France and blogs at wardinfrance.blogspot.com. He reviewed Percy Sledge, The Atlantic Recordings. You can listen to three tracks on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts. You can also join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.